Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the April issue of The Delicious Podcast with me, Julie Smith, and we've got sunshine in our soul. We're off to Rome and Venice to talk about their respective food cultures, and we're breaking bread for Easter with the flower that keeps on giving. We'll find out what Chef Theo Randall's superpower would be in his slice of my life, and we're tasting rose-soaked brioche in the test kitchen. But first, editor Karen Barnes on what's in the magazine this month.
Well, it's spring. Our cover is green and fresh and bright. There are two things that I absolutely love in this issue, which fall within our theme of... it's called the inspiration issue, this one. And I think... It's a bit of an unusual one for us because we always have a lot of heart and soul in Delicious, as you know. But when we were planning this one, everything we were thinking about and suggesting seemed to be sparked from memories and experiences. Mm. So we thought, let's make a virtue of it. And my favourite feature, which I'm flicking through our mocked-up copy of the issue before it's printed, is a feature called Secret Histories, which is... Well, it's really about what the headline says, but it's about the stories behind various famous dishes like omelette Arnold Bennett and...
Who was Arnold Bennett?
Well, yes, I'm not going to tell you now because you've got to read the April issue to find out. And things like carpaccio and nachos, all of these classic recipes have a story behind them. So we tell the story and then we recreate the recipe with a slight twist to it so that there's something a bit different.
A little bit like Valentina Harris talking about pandettone in last month's podcast.
Exactly like that. And we also have a sidebar on... Sidebar is a magazine speak for a box of extra stuff on the page, what I call takeout. It's on the fake news of food because there are lots of fake stories behind recipes as well. And this is there are some really interesting facts in there. But the other feature that links very much into this one, but with a different theme, is a feature all about memories from the Delicious team, talking either about a particular item in the kitchen that has special memories attached to it, or a person or a smell or a recipe that reminds them of a person. And my particular one is, I'm just showing you here a picture of a beautiful bread tin which has my family surname on the side of it, because my granddad was a baker, and this tin is my most treasured possession, and it must be 60 or 70 years old. And when you bake a loaf in it, it has the family name. It comes out with a name on
Amazing.
The side. The bakery, sadly, is no more, but I tell the story of that inside, and we've created a saffron loaf because that was one of the things that was baked in the Cornish bakery that my grandfather ran. But we also have stories about some very special chips and a stir fry by Hugh, our deputy chief sub. It's the pan that one of the first things he ever bought, and he uses it again and again and again. And we have a pan cookie by Jen, which reminds her of her mother. And this is one giant cookie all cooked in one pan with ice cream melting it over the top. And the idea is that you dive in. But the stories are there with the food, and it's very special indeed, I think.
I know that one. I've got the gravy saucepan from my parents.
Have you?
Used it only this last weekend.
These treasures, they never let us down. And they, I think what I describe them as is a bit like a sensory DNA that runs through us and shapes the way we think about food and about what we're going to teach other people how to cook.
I totally agree. I mean, you know, I do cook my mother's gravy in that saucepan because I can't not. I can hear her telling me how to, you know, skim the top and then put the cold water on to make it nice and shiny.
So you think about her every time you use it.
Yeah.
That's what makes it special.
Now, I've been to Rome this spring to stay in a very special villa in the middle of the city where guests are encouraged to live like locals, using the house as if it were their own and following the advice of its owner, Andrea Spalletti Trevelli, on what to do and where to eat. When in Rome, Andrea told me, you need to eat like he does.
Well, when it comes to Roman food, you're usually going for very traditional. So in the sense that the Roman cuisine is very poor, because Rome wasn't a rich city. And the tradition is awful, is interiors, is the tongue, it's the tail. So nothing too fancy.
And certainly not for vegetarians.
Definitely not. Definitely not. We're very big meat eaters. And the thing is that there's no real... People try to turn Roman food into fancy food. But honestly, in my opinion, it doesn't work. Roman food has to stay traditional, trattoria-style food.
Yeah.
Cheap and good.
And here at Villa Spalletti Trevelli, I mean, all the recipes come from your family recipes, don't they?
That's what we try to do.
It's however grand this beautiful, what do you call this, a salon is.
Salone, yeah.
Yeah.
No, the thing is we try to give that traditional twist. Again, my family, my sister, we're all fans of tradition. And honestly, when it comes to Italian food and Roman food especially, it's all about that. Yeah. And here what we try to do is bring on our own tradition. So our family's tradition, my great-great-grandmother's chef tradition, that he lived with her for, I think, over 50 years. So he was practically part of the family at that point.
Yeah.
And we try to repropose that. And same goes for the Roman cuisine. And I think the best restaurants in Rome are those who still manage 40, 50 years after they opened, with all the tourism, the mass tourism. Unfortunately, without any snobbish meaning, but a bit of ignorance that kicked in. Mm. People who really don't know or understand what Roman cuisine is all about.
Is that the people who are coming in to cook for the tourists or the tourists themselves?
The tourists themselves, and then obviously a lot of restaurants will adjust to that.
If I come here as a tourist, not staying with you and not being shown around with you, I find it very difficult to find the food.
Oh, it's a jungle.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, it's absolutely a jungle.
So what should tourists look for?
Tough question, in the sense that if they're going by themselves or relying on sites like TripAdvisor and, you know, but it's all completely random. So something I love, you might hate, and vice versa. So it doesn't make sense to rely on people's advice when it comes to food. Unfortunately, in a touristic city like Rome, especially in the city center, a lot of restaurants that are not awful, but not even authentic or traditional or really good. And you end up, say, eating in a place that's you and the only tourists around you, and it will ruin your Roman experience. It won't make you feel Roman for that night or that day.
Look for Romans
is always a good option, but it's not a very easy to find them because on the other side, Roman restaurants and chefs of Roman restaurants are not very good at promoting themselves. Which is on the other side very good for us locals because
they keep it
not becoming that famous. They still manage to keep that authenticity, that tradition. Yeah. And the right price for the right quality. Mm-hmm. And that's why, for example, one of my favorite places is Da Lilli, where I think it's 15 years now since I started going there. Probably met one foreign couple, maybe two in 15 years. And it's always been the cook, his wife, taking care of the customers. He's in the kitchen. It doesn't get more Roman than them in the city center. So I'm talking city center, because obviously the moment you step out of the touristic areas, everything becomes local. Mm-hmm. But in the center where it's very difficult, and this is steps from the Trastevere areas, which is one of the most touristy, from Campo dei Fiori, they still manage to keep their little hidden oasis of Romanità, we call it. And the food is just divine.
Give me an example.
Oh, they have probably the most amazing, for example, pasta con le frattaglie, which are the chicken interiors, with the rigaglie, not frattaglie. They have the coda alla vaccinara, which is the oxtail done with the tomato sauce, which is incredible. The tripe, the traditional, so the matriciana, the carbonara, the gricia are just to die for. So it's very traditional, very local things, local produce, great things. 20, 30 euros max is what you're gonna spend.
Yeah.
service is very local. Again, it's very homey. So there's no formality whatsoever. Romans don't know how to be formal. We're very outgoing. We're very relaxed. And we don't care about, you know, what the scheme should be. We'll just be very, very friendly with whoever you are. You might be the president of the United States, or Andres Palletti will treat you exactly the same way.
And you can follow the links to his top five restaurants on the blog, Andrea's Foodie Postcard from Rome, at deliciousmagazine.co.uk. Now, before we leave Italy, let's linger in Venice for a moment with finalist for the Jane Grigson Trust New Food Writer Award, Skye McAlpine, who grew up in the city and still lives there with her family. Her stunning new book, A Table in Venice, is the story of her life there through her recipes. And I asked her if learning to eat was the first language she learned.
It really is a way of speaking the local language. And I think because I grew up with these recipes and eating in friends' homes, you know, all my school friends were Venetian, so I'd kind of go back to their house and their mother would cook and I'd be in the kitchen with them. It sort of become part, so much part of my life. I think it's a funny thing, if when you're from one place and live in another, is you never really know what you are. You have no real fixed national identity.
Yes.
But for me, that's been a good thing.
Yes, and interestingly, a lot of people I speak to start to cook food from their homeland when they've been displaced. So I wonder how that works with you living in two different places.
Well, funnily enough, I think the time when I really started to learn how to cook, as in to put a meal from start to finish on the table by myself, was when I came to university in England. And I found myself gravitating towards wanting to make those dishes that I would eat at home, and the food that was so good, and really missing that. Yeah. And feeling the need to recreate it. Yeah. In my student kitchen. Yeah. So I think that's where my real interest in cooking and not just eating really started.
But the food from Venice. Now, as I was reading your book, I realised that I hadn't a clue. I really didn't know what Venetian food was.
Well, I think Venetian food gets a bit of a bad rap. I think partly because Venice is such a magical, enchanting city from both a historical and architectural point of view. So it's very easy to come to Venice and gorge on Tintorettos and Carpaccios and Titians and leave very happy and not really have paid much attention to the food. But the food, as through all of Italy, is, as you say, the language of the people who live there, and more than anything for me, it's how the city comes to life. It is worth sort of moving past those little trattorie catering to the tourist trade that you would sort of obviously fall upon, and really trying to investigate how you can eat well. So the focus of the book really is home cooking, and it's the recipes that we make at home or that I ate in friends' homes, or I did a lot of research from old traditional Venetian cookbooks written in dialect and kind of looking at those recipes. But what is wonderful about good Italian restaurants is that they are like an extension of the home. The really good restaurants for me are not the smart or chic ones. They're the ones where it's a family run, where the mother and the daughter will be in the kitchen, the father will be front of house. And so they will cook, the food that they eat is kind of home cooking.
Give us an example.
So, for example, I love our local pizzeria, which is just around the corner from where we live. It's called Pizzeria da Paolo, and it's a very unchic establishment. But Paolo is completely enchanting, and it's a completely family-run business, and Odina cooks in the kitchen, and you can go there and look at their menu, and they're probably like 50 different varieties of pizza. Or you can go in and say, Paolo, cosa mangiate oggi? Cosa mangiamo oggi? What are you eating today? And he'll bring you the incredible pasta that he's having for his family dinner there in the restaurant, and then he'll bring out, you know, I don't know, some fantastic razor clams and some lovely vongole, and say, oh, we've got some moeke, the little soft shell crabs, they just came in today, have some of these. So kind of you really need to, I think, engage with the waiters and with the restaurants and sort of say, what should I eat, what do you recommend?
I wonder how Paolo would feel. A whole load of delicious readers came in. Paolo, what are you eating today?
I think he'd be thrilled.
I dare you to try it. It's a very beautiful book, and you took the photographs.
I did. Thank you. That's very kind of you.
It really is. I mean, the pages for the recipes are salmon pink, which is your signature colour. I'm looking at your fridge and I'm looking at your walls here. And this sort of reflects your blog as well. Yeah.
I mean, I love pink. I've always loved pink. It drives my mother mad, actually. She never let me wear pink as a little girl. And all I ever wanted as a result was a pink dress. And now I have a pink book and a pink house and a pink life. So, but it's kind of a reflection. I think Venice is quite a pink city. There's that kind of lovely faded colour to the plaster of the walls, but has sort of those soft shades of dirty pink to it.
Yeah, it's a beautiful book, and it gives a different layer to Venice. I'm wondering if people reading it and then going for a holiday in Venice would have a completely different experience. Is that what you wanted?
That's what I really wanted. I hope so. I think Venice, it's such a funny city because there's such a huge tourist industry. I think it's over 20 million visitors a year and a population of about 50,000 people. And there's been a lot of talk recently about tourism and what is responsible tourism. And I think if we could fill Venice with people who are excited to be there and interested in the people who live there and the life there and the food that we cook there and what we do there, that would be a wonderful, wonderful thing. It would be a real privilege to have been a part of that in some way.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Now, April is about Easter, Passover, and breaking bread with family and friends. But what's in your loaf? Michael Hansen is a third-generation baker who's taking bread making back to basics with Bread for Life. Growing his wheat from 90-year-old heritage seeds and raising money from the flour to those living on the breadline. I joined him as he sent his very first shipment of the flour off to market and asked him what heritage seeds are.
Heritage grains are really varieties that are before the Green Revolution, which was in the 60s, but you can go back up until really the sort of 50s, where agriculture really started to change in this country. Mm-hmm. We, my colleague and I, John Letts, he's an archaeobotanist, he discovered these grains, and we've collected them, and he's collected them.
Where from?
Well, basically from seed banks around the world, some of the seed banks in the Middle East. Modern seeds are very different to the old open pollinated seeds. Mm.
Less and, natural, shall we say?
Yeah, very. They don't need the inputs, right. Precisely.
Yeah. And when you're talking inputs, you're talking about being grown intensively with chemicals.
Yes. Yeah. So the old varieties of seeds, because of their very nature, because they're old, these are pre-1930s. Mm-hmm. They grew really well without the fertilizers and the chemicals. Mm-hmm. And so they're the type of seeds that we find. I was actually collected some seeds, some ancient heritage wheat in Georgia, which is actually the home of wheat. It's the home of wine, but it's also the home of wheat. And I was over there in November, and some of those seeds I've brought back, and I'm going to be planting those locally along with my other heritage varieties.
So you grow it on a farm in Telscombe in Sussex, mm-hmm. and you create this flour, Bread for Life. Now that's mm-hmm. a special flour. Tell us about what it's for.
Well, Bread for Life, really, it grew out of the soup kitchen that I used to run in Lewes, which was a soup for Syria sort of kitchen. It was a donation only, so we would donate the bread and volunteers would make the soup, and then people would come in and they would pay a donation, yeah. whatever you wanted. Yeah. So some people would put a tenner in the pot, some people would put 10 pence in. And that idea really took off, and we had the soup for Syria, then we get the bake for Syria, cook for Syria.
In that you were raising money for Syria, so part of the donations were going to Syria.
Yeah, but out of that, that sort of planted a little seed of what we could use bread for or flour for. And really from that, I developed that notion that Bread for Life would be a social enterprise. So what happens is Bread for Life donates the profit to those people living on the breadline. So although we still support Syria and we still support Calais, we also help people really close to home. So mm-hmm. the Brighton Homeless, Streets Kitchen are a great organisation that we support, and we still support the people in Calais. And that's what Bread for Life is all about. It's helping people on the breadline.
Yeah, and it's a good time to talk about charity, isn't it? It's Easter time. You know, bread has always been right at the heart, hasn't it, mm-hmm. of giving.
All the major religions have bread at the heart of them. And, you know, for one really big reason, and that's because bread is the staff of life. It really is what you break your fast with bread. The notion of breaking bread and sharing bread with your brother or your sister is central to humanity, and there's no getting away from it. When in our culture, bread is a symbolic, it's a metaphor for all sorts of things, which is why Bread for Life, I believe, is such a strong, powerful symbol and metaphor.
And you can buy Bread for Life online at bakerybits.co.uk. Now, in our regular feature, mirroring Delicious Magazine's Slice of My Life, I put the questionnaire to Chef Thea Randall at the Intercontinental Hotel in Park Lane. As someone who trained with the legendary Alice Waters at Chez Panisse in California, I couldn't imagine anyone more inspiring.
Well, I've been very lucky. I've been working with some brilliant people, and most of them women. Alice Waters was an amazing inspiration. I was at Chez Panisse for a short period of time, but that whole time there was incredibly inspirational. I mean, also working with a great chef called Paul Bertoli. But Alice is just one of these people that just gets the best out of people. And her inspirational thoughts and ideas are why Chez Panisse is such a brilliant restaurant and still is today.
Yeah, I mean, she was really the first to bring that idea of local seasonal, the idea of, you know, isn't it, the very short menu based on what's available. Has that really been an influence on your cooking?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think back at the time, I was at Chez Panisse in 1991, and there were menus being written with the name of the producer. It wasn't a very detailed description of the dish. It was very much about what the produce was. And the produce was always absolutely perfect. And all the people that would be delivering to the restaurant would usually be the farmers themselves and wanting to see Alice and getting her feedback on their latest creation. But it was the way she did things. There was a great guy called Steve Sullivan who had, she would get given the opportunity to bake. He's absolutely mad about baking bread. And she gave me the opportunity to bake bread using the ovens when the restaurant was closed in the evening. She said, all I want is like 6 sourdough loaves for the restaurant. So, you know, you can make them and use whatever you want, the flour, whatever. But, you know, make sure I have these 6 loaves. So he sort of practiced and tried and tried. And eventually, after, you know, quite a few months, started to make these absolutely perfect sourdoughs using the ash of the fire to give it that lovely sort of black crust. And he started up a bakery called Acme Bakery, and he actually was the person that invented the San Francisco sourdough. Wow. And just to give you an idea that, you know, how many things that have been created from Chez Panisse. I mean, like little microleaf salads that you see every day, you get used to in supermarkets. That came from, you know, Alice and yeah. a friend of hers, and she gave them a chance to sort of grow these tiny vegetables. And then all these things like beetroots and these tiny, delicious lamb and wonderful ingredients. She was an inspiration to a lot of people, yeah. a lot of chefs, and a lot of chefs have opened restaurants on the back of that.
And consumers as well. I mean, farmers markets came out of
I mean,
Alice
Waters. Monterey Market is probably the finest farmers market in the world. I mean, it's extraordinary. I mean, you know, you go there and you see what produce you see there is extraordinary. And it was a whole sort of revolution of people. I mean, it was kind of quite extraordinarily inspirational, healthy food that was delicious. And that's what food is today, really.
Yeah, it was about stripping it right back down to the essentials. First foodie memory.
First foodie memory, that's a tough one. My mother, it's not really a memory, my mother said the first word I ever said was chocolate, and that was because I used to sit in a cot or a pram, and there was a door hatch on the top, and it was a kind of one of those sort of catches that made a kind of noise. And my first word was, and it turned out to be lit. And that was because the chocolate was kept in that cupboard. But I think my first real food memories, my mum's a brilliant cook, and I remember always her baking. I remember making pancakes, the little dropped pancakes and jam. And she's always cooked. I mean, always just been a brilliant cook. It's just very natural for her. So it was part of my growing up to sort of the smell of baking cakes or homemade food. And it was just like, you know, I was the kid that went to school with the homemade bread and gorgonzola sandwich, where everyone else had mother's pride with ham and mustard. And I used to go, I was so embarrassed, I used to go around the corner and buy a packet of crisps, so I didn't feel like too much of a weirdo, particularly with all these kind of plasticky things that other people were putting in their lunchboxes.
It didn't make you the most popular boy in school, though.
Not at all, but I think, you know, it's helped in years to come. But I mean, to the point where my mother would make this sort of sandwich, and then she'd sort of pick an apple from the garden and a bunch of grapes in the greenhouse, and that was my packed lunch, and it all was okay until a friend came to stay who was very used to very much a plastic packed lunch, and when he saw his lunch he was a bit horrified.
I decided to throw in a curveball by asking him what his superpower would be.
Oh my god, that's the hardest question I think I've ever been asked. Well, I probably quite like Spider-Man. It'd be quite nice to be able to climb up walls and get places quicker, because I always find that I'm late for lots of meetings, so being able to have a web and get across London very quickly would be quite handy.
I think his web was more about saving the world, actually,
well,
rather
know,
than getting
to
places.
He gets places very quickly.
Okay, foodie wisdom. In all your years working with all these extraordinary people, one piece of foodie wisdom that you would like to pass on to either a fellow chef or somebody who loves to cook?
Always trust your instinct. It's probably the most important thing. I mean, instinct is a very valuable thing, and I think you don't take it seriously enough. And I think when you actually trust your instinct when you're cooking, it's the only way to cook, because then you know when not to add extra things, you know when to stop cooking. I mean, the problem with cooks and young chefs particularly is they tend to overdo things because they see there's lots of ingredients and they're going to be over creative, and sometimes less is more. And I think if you can control yourself and, you know, get the seasoning right, use the right produce, use the right quantities, then trusting your instinct is the best way to do it.
And so to the test kitchen, where food editor Jen Bedlow was busy opening some rather interesting baker's boxes to try out some cakes for the magazine's Chef Step by Step feature. I asked if she needed a hand.
We've come to the test kitchen on quite a good day, actually, Ginny. We have been sent some rather delicious looking pastries to try. Well, we're going to try them basically to see if we would like the recipe to feature a chef step by step.
So how does it, you know, just because people send you a really good looking little package here doesn't mean that they're going to be named in the magazine or indeed that you're going to do anything with it at all?
No, so what we're looking for here, for chef step by step, we want something that's got an element of learning and skill, but not too much that you're just going to look at it and think, I'm never going
that.
To make that.
Yeah.
And so we've basically identified something we'd like to put in the issue, and we've gone to this baker and asked, could we have your secret recipe, basically.
So what is this one?
It's a soaked brioche, a rose syrup soaked brioche.
Ooh,
And as you can see, there's a bit of pistachio going on, and we've obviously got a beautiful looking rose.
So why are you only cutting one piece? It looks quite dense and heavy, but it's actually quite nice, isn't it?
It's quite a strong rose flavour, actually.
Mm.
So quite unusual, not too sweet.
Mm.
We would need to look at the recipe and look at the processes, and if it's going to take you 3 days, then we'd have to really make a judgment call on whether or not anyone's going to do that at home. And if the flavour, you know, obviously if something tastes incredible, then we're not going to deprive our readers of knowing how it was done.
And we won't say who the bakery is, just in case they don't make it to the pages. But if they do get through, obviously you would then credit the baker.
Yeah, well, the baker would come on our shoot, basically, and run the recipe through. We would do step-by-step shots. So, because this obviously is a recipe that would have a little extra element of skill or technique needed. So step-by-step photography allows you to really see what it should look like at every step of the way. And then we'd have a lovely introduction written by our baker and a bit about them and where you can actually go and just buy their lovely products as well.
So it's a lovely showcase for up-and-coming chefs and bakers.
Yeah, you don't have to be famous. If the recipe is, if you're the expert of a recipe, then that's who we want to write it.
And in case you're wondering who that mystery baker is, I can now tell you that it's Dominique Ansel. And this recipe will indeed be in a future issue of the magazine. Thanks for listening to The Delicious Podcast. Next week, we've got a special extended extra portion with Diana Henry in her very first interview on her brand new book, How to Eat a Peach. And don't forget to let us know what you'd like to hear on the podcast via any of the Delicious social media channels. See you next week.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.